You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The setting that Philip Roth chose for his latest novel, Nemesis, will be familiar to readers of many of his 30 previous books, a Jewish enclave in Newark during World War II. His protagonist is Eugene Bucky Cantor, a 23-year-old playground director who watches with despair as the children he supervises begin to sicken and die during a polio epidemic. Mr. Roth is among America's most celebrated writers. During his nearly 50-year-long career, he's won, among other awards, the Pulitzer Prize, two National Book Awards, and three Penn Faulkner Awards. This latest is published by Houghton Mifflin, and I'm very pleased that it brings Philip Roth back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
It may be difficult for listeners under 60 to understand just how terrifying those outbreaks of polio were. Was 1944 a particularly bad year?
No, there was no epidemic in Newark in 1944.
So this is just another work of fiction by Philip Roth.
Yes, it's another work of fiction.
Well, 1916 was really bad, but I remember when I was a kid.
1916 in the Northeast was very bad.
When I was a kid, that was, you know, in years later in the 40s and all, we were very aware of polio and electric, I mean, the iron lungs were, we would see them during newsreels in the movies.
Right.
It was a very scary time.
And the iron lung was especially frightening, you know, frightening to look at and obviously frightening for those who had to enter it.
You know? And parents warned their kids, you know, don't go to the pool. During the summer.
Well, they were right. The pool would have been a good place to pick it up because it's in fecal matter that the virus is spread, and so it could be spread in a swimming pool.
But did people know that at the time?
No. No one knew how it was spread. No one – it had no cause, no cure.
Until Jonas Salk came up with a vaccine.
In 54, 55, there was Salk, and then in 1960, there was Sabin with his vaccine. And that ended polio.
In this country, because polio still exists elsewhere.
In a few countries, yes.
In your novel, the mayor warns Newark residents to be vigilant about swatting household flies that may carry the disease. It wasn't borne by flies, was it?
No, it wasn't. But what they knew is that malaria had been spread by mosquitoes, and there was malaria out of the meadowlands and the mosquitoes there in Newark. So that had been taken care of. Yes, people were – well, they were afraid of everything, actually.
Well, some of the residents accuse Horace, the neighborhood simpleton, of spreading the disease.
Yeah. Well, the boys do. The boys on the playground. Horace is the neighborhood simpleton, as you say. He hangs around with the kids, though they don't interact. And one of the kids decides that he's the carrier. That strange fellow is the carrier.
But to some degree, he could have been because he wasn't big on hand washing and he liked to shake everyone's hands.
It could have been, yeah.
Since there's been so much discussion in the past about your books being autobiographical, I'm going to ask you right out front. Well, we know that there was no polio epidemic of any real magnitude in 1944 in Newark, but had you ever worked as a playground director?
No, but I was a kid. I was a kid who spent my life at the playground.
Uh-huh.
And so I remember the playground directors and how important to us they were and how we looked up to them, especially if they had some kind of athletic achievement in their background.
Now, many writers invent a fictional equivalent of their hometowns in their novels. Was it important to you to set these books in the Newark that you really grew up in?
Yeah, sure. That's the way I go about it. Someone else may go about it another way. But Bellows said his books in the Chicago he grew up in.
And then in the Upper West Side.
Yeah, and then Faulkner said his books in the Jefferson County, Mississippi, that he grew up in. I think it's more common for American writers to name the place than not, actually.
Mm.
What intrigued me about using my place in this, my place I came from in this book was I wanted to answer the question, what would have become of us? What would have happened to us had this menace we feared so much come to pass? And so I used my neighborhood, the kids, and so on.
Well, all of the kids who escaped coming down with polio felt like something special had happened to them because they'd gotten through.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that way when you were a kid?
I think I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I never wound up getting the vaccine for one reason or another. So I've escaped all my life.
And I'm sitting opposite you?
It's okay. I think that the threat has passed us by. Plague has been a subject of any number of notable novels in the past, beginning with Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year. And then, of course, Camus' The Plague was one of the classics of the 20th century. Were you thinking about them when you were thinking about writing this book?
I read them. Not when I was thinking about writing the book, when I was in the middle of the book, really. I wanted to see what they'd done with this kind of situation, what they'd done with an epidemic or a plague that threatened to overwhelm the community. So, of course, I mean, what writer wouldn't read those books?
Did you think that they did it well?
I think they did it both. They both did it brilliantly. Yeah.
In the case of Defoe, he's kind of in as much as anyone inventing the novel while he's doing that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So it's even a greater achievement.
And perhaps it's Camus' greatest work, The Plague.
Although they forced me to read The Stranger in college, in French. Yes. When your novel opens, Bucky is one of the few young men of military age left in Newark. Why hasn't he enlisted to fight along with his two best friends?
Well, he tried to enlist. He tried passionately to enlist, but he was rejected for bad eyesight. And so there's another thing that's eating away at his conscience, which is I should be fighting with my pals in the war. And that was true of a lot of boys who were kept out of the war and declared 4F at that time.
And I'm sure that some people looked askance at somebody who looked perfectly fit, who wasn't in uniform at the time.
I think people did.
He didn't encounter that much in your novel. Unlike during the Vietnam War, young men did feel guilty and ashamed of not being able to fight overseas.
Well, some in the Vietnam War, some felt guilty and ashamed for fighting.
Hmm. But most of the Bucky's pressure comes from within.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you might take the title Nemesis to apply as much to his conscience as it applies to the epidemic.
Bucky has been taught to value hard work, honesty, and responsibility above all other qualities by his maternal grandparents who raised him after his mother died in childbirth. Wasn't his absent father also a source of shame for Bucky?
Yes, he was. He was a petty thief, but he served time. And then when he came out of jail, he remarried and tried to get custody of Bucky, and there's a dispute between the grandfather and his father. The grandfather doesn't want the father to have him. The grandfather prevails.
Now, this is not autobiographical again, but most writers will tell you that these kinds of details do come from things that they witness throughout their lives.
Oh, sure. You use everything you know. I knew, to begin with, I knew the place. In the second part of the book, you know, the action moves to a summer camp where Bucky goes to work with his girlfriend who's there. And though I never was a camper in one of those camps, I, in college, was a counselor in one in the Poconos. And so I used that, drew upon that material for that section of the book.
And he goes to the Poconos, or they go to the Poconos partly to escape the threat of the polio plague in Newark.
Well, he does.
Mm-hmm. Fresh air.
This is the... Well, fresh air, without the contaminants of a city. This was thought to be true back then, which was people would rush off to the Jersey Shore thinking they would be free of the polio menace there, or they'd go to the mountains. And maybe they were right. Who knows?
Now, Bucky is a nickname given to him by his grandfather, but it's a rather unusual name for a Jewish kid.
Is it?
Yeah. Did you know any Buckys when you were a kid?
I knew a Bucky who was one of our teachers in school, football coach.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that unusual. It's kids picked up nicknames. Lots of kids had nicknames. He gets this from his grandfather, who thinks it has a manly air to it.
Well, he also is especially skilled at diving and javelin throwing, and not sports that I normally would associate with a Jewish kid from the city.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Jewish kids wanted to play basketball.
Well, every high school had a track and field team. And I remember, I wasn't a member of the track or field team. My brother was. But I remember walking up past the field where they practiced and being tremendously hypnotized. I was probably 8 or 9 years old by the guys throwing the shot and for distances, and the fellows pole vaulting, and the guys throwing the javelin. It was always magical to me.
Now, he has very bad eyesight, but it doesn't matter in those sports.
No.
Is the poor eyesight something of a metaphor for Buck? He's not being able to see events clearly later in the story?
Mm-mm.
You don't think in those ways?
No, I don't
think in those. There is right now some graduate student who's going to make all those connections.
Well, good. But no, I don't think in those ways. He has poor eyesight because I wanted the character to have poor eyesight. Mm-hmm. I wanted him not to be able to go into the Army. So there is something arbitrary about what I did, but I wanted him not to go in the Army.
But you wanted him to be physically fit at the
exactly.
same time.
Exactly. Yeah, so the eyes were good. And I do know, I knew of a cousin of mine who didn't go in the Army because of the bad eyesight.
Now, I don't want to go into what happens because I don't want to spoil things. There are surprises. But a number of reviewers, including J.M. Coetzee, in a very, very warm, lauding review, was very happy to tell us what happens at the end.
I'm not.
Does that bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me at all. I don't think what happens at the end matters. What happens is how you get to the end. And you're not going to tell them how I got to the end. They're going to have to read that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do that. You sure? My guest is Philip Roth, whose latest novel is called Nemesis. And it is published by Houghton Mifflin. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with one of America's leading writers, maybe in some people's minds, our greatest writer, Philip Roth, whose latest book from Harcourt, from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, is Nemesis. You don't reveal your story's narrator until 100 pages into the book, and you don't give any clues to the role that the narrator plays in the story until quite near the end. Why not have Bucky tell the story?
Well, I thought it was better being told from the outside, but by someone who was there, by an observer, by another boy. So what you have as a narrator is another boy who was there as a man telling the story.
Bucky undergoes a crisis of faith a few days after an encounter with some Italian boys when two of the children he worked with at the playground come down with polio and die. He questions how God could let children die. And that's the same sort of question that many Jews ask after the full extent of the Holocaust became known, and people who survived the Holocaust.
I think it's a question many people ask all the time. And Bucky is just discovering that question. He's only 22 or 23 years old. And now in the face of this tragedy, this murdering of children, he says, where is God in all this? And if there is a God, then he's not a good God. Therefore, I despise him. So this is a way of reasoning that many people go through, especially in the face of tragedy or loss.
His girlfriend, Marcia, does have a stronger faith than he does, or at least a different kind of faith. And her faith isn't shaken by the polio epidemic.
No. She holds a God unaccountable for what happens. And the answer is that she gives Bucky is, you cannot know the nature of God. I mean, she doesn't say it in those many words, but that's her position.
Well, but that's what religious people always say. God works in mysterious ways. You said that Marcia was the first character you developed for this novel, that you started with the idea that she was worried for her boyfriend and wanted to protect him. Is that true?
No, I don't know. Where did I say that?
I don't know. Well, I read it on the internet. The internet is full of information that's sometimes quite valuable and sometimes wrong.
Yes. No, I began this book with polio. I began this book by looking back over the period of years I'd lived and trying to see what had I, as it were, left out that was of importance in America, not just to me, but in America. And that's how I came upon polio. And I began with the disease, and then I had to build a story, which meant I had to build a character and a place and so on.
Marcia's really a wonderful person. And the reviewer in the New York Times Book Review, who was a front page of the Book Review and a rave, but she talked about having a prejudice against your work for a long time. Then after she read this book, she went back and had to go through a reevaluation. But One of the problems she had was the way she thought you wrote about women. Mm-hmm. And here we have this woman that is just, you know, an exemplary character.
There have been many exemplary characters in my books who have been women, but that's neither here nor there. This is this girl is young, pretty, smart, devoted, and in love with this guy. And she comes to him when he's in the hospital after he's been crippled by polio. And she says, you know, let's go ahead with what we have. And he says no to her. And this is he makes several big decisions in the book, and this is one. And he says no for an obvious reason. He articulates it almost, that he doesn't want her to live with the cripple that he is. And she'll be better off marrying somebody else and having children and so on. For him, it's a gigantic sacrifice. In fact, he never really recovers from it. And for her, we don't know. We don't know what happened to her.
Well, this is all part of the same sort of thinking that that he went through when he couldn't go to fight in the war. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he has a certain sense of what he should be in society, and then life keeps on intruding.
That's true.
A number of reviewers have remarked on a change in the way that you've been using language in less complex sentences, and they see a gentler tone in the more recent books. Is that something that you have thought about?
No, nothing conscious. This, you know, the book calls forth its language, assuming that you have all your mental properties and can do what you like. The book calls forth the language, and you write in a way that seems to you, as you're going, associated with the subject. It creates an aura that should be consistent with the subject.
Well, in this case, you have a narrator, and so you're writing it in his voice,
as it were. Yeah.
Well, how do you decide on the voice of a narrator anyway? You can write. In this case, we're talking about a man who, Bucky, who's mm-hmm. Not as smart as some of your previous protagonists, but. A narrator can be as smart or as out of it as the writer desires.
Well, like, to remind you what you said earlier, Bucky is not the narrator.
No, I understand.
Though he's smart enough, you know. He's not stupid. He's smart enough.
But you even have the narrator say that he's not the sharpest, not those words, but not the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, you work your way into that. You work your way into the discovery of the voice. You work your way in, as you're writing. You work your way into the discovery of the character and the action. So it's a matter of churning out the pages, one, two, three a day, whatever you get, and finding the pitch. Your first draft is not your final draft anyway, and in many places you don't find the pitch. And one of the things you're doing when you're going over the book for the second or third draft is leveling it out, as it were.
And did it start off with the same narrator?
I didn't know who was narrating in the beginning. I just knew there was a we, who I wanted the voice of the boys, as it were, to be narrating this story. So I started out with a we, and I kept going along. And at one point, I gave a list of the boys who had come down with polio, and one of them was my narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually he comes forward at the end, and he is also a polio victim, as Bucky is, but with a very different take on what's happened to him.
Is this the way you've generally written over the years, starting off without a sense of who your narrator is and then working that out?
Yes. I start with very little. I start with crumbs. I don't have a character. I have usually a situation, and there's somebody in that situation. But I don't have other people. I often don't have a place. And I write my way into the knowledge of the book. That's the only way I can do it.
Okay. Often it sounds like it's what if, or at least in some of the books, what if?
It's always what if. In some books, it's more obviously what if, as in The Plot Against America and in Nemesis. But in the other books, it's what if. What if this happened to somebody? What if a guy's daughter blew up a building during the Vietnam War? And that's American Pastoral.
My guest is Philip Roth, whose latest novel is Nemesis. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the front of the book, you have included a list of your previous work organized into categories. There are the Zuckerman books, the Roth books, the Kepish books, and you've created a new category called Nemesis Short Novels, which includes this book and the three that preceded it, Indignation, Every Man, and The Humbling. Will you tell us why you grouped those novels together and how they are related? They don't have any characters in common, and only two of them are set in Newark.
Oh, you mean these last,
last
four novels, short novels, really. What I realized as I was writing my way into them, and I had no plan to write them, by the way, but I began to write them, was that in each book there was a cataclysm that occurs that destroys the hero. And the cataclysm is different in each book, but they all had this gloom fate hanging over them. And they seem to me to belong together in terms of the moral aura of it, and in terms of this similarity in cataclysm after cataclysm.
Well, Indignation was first person narrated.
Yeah.
And that's because that's the only way you could have told that story?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Probably it could be told 10 other ways. That's the way I found to tell it, yeah.
At least one reviewer, Tim Martin of the London Daily Telegraph, wrote that he was concerned that a sentence at the end of your biography at the back of the novel indicated that you're retiring from writing. It says, the last of 9 volumes of your work to be published in a comprehensive definitive edition by the Library of America scheduled for publication in 2013. That's just 3 years from now. Was Mr. Martin's concern justified? Are you thinking of retiring?
That line from the Library of America copy used to read eight volumes and 2012. Uh-huh. So since I wrote these four books, they've added another volume, ninth volume, which will come out in 2013. So no, it doesn't mean anything.
So we can assume that more books are coming out. But will they be a new series? Because there's a suggestion that all of those other series have had a certain completion.
I have no idea.
You don't know.
I don't know what 77-year-old guys write. You know, I'll find out.
Really? I mean, you don't have a plague or something that is itching you at the back of your mind now?
No, I have nothing itching me, truly.
Well, one of the things that Jem Coetzee suggested is that the thing that makes a plague so good to write about is that it is about a heightened state of the condition of being mortal.
Mm-hmm.
And as we get older, we often think a lot more about that than we did when we were kids. I'm not... Mm-hmm. And all of these last four books have been about death.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they have. Well, I'm not unconscious of death. And I see my friends dying. And my closest friends, my relatives have already died, my family. And my friends are dying, and many are already dead. So, of course, I confront death all the time through them. If I were, I could think of it on my own as well, but I confront death through them all the time. And it colors what I'm thinking about.
Well, they say at a certain age, people start reading the obituary page every day.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I do.
I do too.
And Roz Chast had a wonderful cartoon some years ago where a person reading the obituary page says, oh, 3 years younger than me. Oh, I have 15 more years to go.
That's very good.
Looking at each different obituary.
That, of course, is what you think when you see those numbers there, yes.
Why did you give Bucky this complicated back history? His father being a thief. Is that any clue as to his character?
Well, in as much as he wants not to be that.
Is about a person trying to improve himself, always be as good as he can be?
Yes, and not be anything faintly resembling what the father was. Then his mother he lost when he was born. So that's just a gigantic hole in his life. And I have some pages of when he thinks about her, sees her photograph and so on. I wanted it to have been a stern life, a tough life. I don't ask me why. That's the way I conceived the character from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And the whole matter of the crisis of faith is that, I mentioned it in connection to the Holocaust, which of course was occurring at the same time mm-hmm. that this polio epidemic was happening in Newark, mm-hmm. at least according to your book. Was there no sense, because you have written about the Holocaust in the past, was there no sense of that connection?
I can't follow the question.
The fact that people lost their faith in God as a result.
Yes,
the question.
I know that, but it didn't figure in my writing of this book. But we don't need polio to make us think of that. We need any ghastly disease at all will make people think that way. That is not a problem for those of us who don't believe. The nature of God is not a problem. But for those who do believe, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. And is the nature of God a topic that you find is an interesting subject for a novelist to write about?
Not me. Uh-huh. I have no interest in it whatsoever.
So this is part of the fun of writing a book is becoming somebody whose way of thinking is so totally different from your own?
The logic of his experience leads him to ask those questions.
Mm-hmm. Because I've spoken to a number of writers about whether you write out of your sense of convictions or whether the characters just take over and they become who they become. I remember Cynthia Ozick, who has very strong political beliefs, telling me that if her characters ever sound like they're mouthpieces for her, she has failed as a novelist.
I think that's true. Yeah, what's in it for the writer if the character is a mouthpiece? Propaganda isn't art.
On the other hand, you are somebody who has strong beliefs. How do you get past that? Is it that you can just totally get involved in somebody else's mind?
I don't think beliefs, at least in my case, and I think probably in Cynthia's as well, that once you're doing your work, you have so much to worry about. The last thing you hear about is your beliefs, you know, or propagandizing for your beliefs.
You're just trying to figure out where the story's going to go.
You're just trying to figure out the next page.
And you said that this book took three drafts? Is that
maybe true? Maybe more. I forget.
Really?
Yeah.
I would think that an experienced writer like you, somebody who really knows how to write a great sentence, mm-hmm. wouldn't have that problem anymore.
Well, I do. Because the problem is this, that I've written for a long time now, but I've never written this book before. So everything I've learned from writing the other books doesn't mean anything when I approach this book. So you have to discover the book, as I said, as you're writing it. And it takes time. And then you write sloppily sometimes just to keep going. You can't write so sloppily that it's offensive to you, but you write sloppy just to keep the damn thing going.
Have you ever wondered about Flaubert, who would not proceed until he had the exact right word each time?
No, he probably did the right thing.
Well, it's a different way. One of the things I've discovered in talking to writers is that there's no one right way mm-hmm. to write. It's just how you get to the end.
Well, you're really everybody, the mot juste, he said. Everybody's struggling for the mot juste. That's what you're struggling with, in my case, in the third draft. But if I looked for that in the first draft, the perfect word, I wouldn't proceed.
And as you're writing that first draft, does it just start taking on a life of its own? Do you have a sense as you're working where you're going to go?
That develops.
Did you know that Bucky was going to come down with polio?
No, I had no idea. That develops, and sometimes the developments come very late, which is again why you've got to go back and accommodate them earlier. So no, I discovered the book in that draft, the first draft.
My guest has been Philip Roth, whose latest novel. How many did I say you've written so far?
I think this is number 31.
Well, and three drafts, and you're still
walking and talking. Amazing.
It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it's been my great honor to have you as a guest again.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.